Thank you.
Rabbi Kalman.
Yeah.
Thank
Yes,
you,
sir.
everybody
Okay.
who's here. And let us delve right in. Let's just recap since we are, skipped for 2 weeks. Let's just recap and see where we're standing. So far, we started the book with high expectations. It seemed for one brief moment as if the people are about to claim ownership over both their future and their covenant with God. They start strong by approaching God as a people and asking him who should lead them next. Except that from that moment on, that high moment of expectation breaks apart into one disappointing event after another. And we meet the three great cardinal sins of the era of the judges. The lack of brotherhood, where people are not helping each other and tribes fall apart and in their weakened state can't quite take control over the land, over the country they're in, which is their second sin. And that leads to idolatry. Because generation after generation, they forget the stories that brought them, the histories that brought them to where they are, and instead become tempted by the culture around them. And that leads to God abandoning them, to the mercies or lack thereof of their other nations, them suffering through subjugation and violence and calling out to God, God sending a judge, the judge saving them, returning their hearts to God in their lifetime, dying, and then forgetting again, being tempted by idolatry again, and so on and so on and so forth. And last time when we met right before my trip, we ended on a particularly gruesome and unpleasant note with a story of Avimelech, who was not a God-ordained judge in the same way the other judges were, but rather the son of the great judge Gideon, who took his father's legacy and his claim to limelight as his father's son and used it in the most horrific way possible to commit fratricide on a huge scale, on a truly horrific scale, and then make himself king. And we saw how that did not end very well. And on the face of it, the story we're about to read today seems an improvement. We are once again going into the familiar cycle of abandonment of God, God abandoning the people, calling out, judge coming, etc., which after the story of Amalek feels almost like a return to normalcy. But as we will see today, this variation on the cycle, the variation that revolves around a man named Iftach, and anyone who ever read the book of Judges perhaps feels a frisson of alarm at this name because we know where it goes, to children being sacrificed, daughters. While indeed being a nicer story, perhaps, at least on the outset, than the story of Avimelech, also allows us a little bit of a deeper look at the abandonment and betrayal that start every cycle. Because in our story, the abandonment isn't only an abandonment of God. It's not just that the people betray God by forgetting what they owe him. In parallel to this betrayal, we see the people betraying Iftach. And throughout the story of Iftach, we see not only the repetition of the pattern that was established in the beginning of the book, that pattern I already reminded you of the cycle of abandonment, betrayal, call out, judge, betrayal, etc. But also within the story, there's constantly parallels, first between God and Iftach, and later, as we will see, between Iftach's family life and the national home, the national family, so to speak. So without further ado, let us start untangling these parallels and see how the story forces us to put Iftach and God side by side and try and understand better what happens in this era by making this comparison. I'm going to open the source sheet here on my computer. And I'll start with chapter 10, where we learn about the people's betrayal of God. The Israelites again did what was offensive to the Lord. They served the Baalim and the Ashtoreth and the gods of Aram, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the Ammonites, and the gods of the Philistines. They forsook the Lord and did not serve him. Eliezer Chiyun, an Israeli scholar, in his book about, not really about judges, but about in general the idea of kingship in Tanakh, points out that this pasuk doesn't describe irreligious people. It describes an uber-religious people. They don't worship God, but they worship every other god you can even think about. They're not saying, oh, let's worship this one God. He is the true God. They're not like the Israelites with the golden calf who celebrate the creation of this one idol and say, these are your God, Israel, who brought you out of Egypt. No. These are people who are frantically holding on to every possible God in the pantheons, a very possible neighbor, grasping at whatever promise of security these many gods can give them. This is only the first inkling we get, and we will note several others, of the fact that this is a society extremely preoccupied with safety and survival, extremely concerned with guaranteeing its own, every person, guaranteeing their own continued living, continued success. Of course, when we see people grasping at the security supplied by the promise of so many gods, there's some anxiety that seeps through. This is not people who are confident in their faith. These are people who are grasping at everything, which in a sense tells us that that which they're grasping for is what they lack. If they're so preoccupied with survival, it's because survival is not guaranteed. And indeed, we will see many more indications of exactly that, of the way that this is a society where survival is a difficult and ongoing challenge, and how that fact affects the mores of the time. But for now, let us continue. I'm in verse 7. And the Lord, incensed with Israel, surrendered them to the Philistines and the Ammonites. That year, they battered and shattered the Israelites for 18 years. All the Israelites beyond the Jordan in what had been the land of the Amorites in Gilead. The Ammonites also crossed the Jordan to make war on Judah, Benjamin, and the house of Ephraim. Israel was in great distress. Now, the rest of this chapter goes on to describe what happens as a result of this distress, but I will pause here. Because as I said, soon after, we encounter Iftach, and I want to really look at these two stories in parallel and see how there's a pattern that repeats itself. So I'm going to move ahead, and we'll come back to verse 10 later. I'm going to move ahead to box number 2, and I say thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Rabbi Kelman posted a link to the source sheet in the chat. In the very next chapter, after we hear about this distressing geopolitical reality, we hear the following story. Iftach the Gileadites, from the same Gilead that's now being battered by the Ammonites, yes, was an able warrior who was the son of a prostitute. Iftach's father was Gilead. Now, some people point out, some commentators, more in the academic vein than in the traditional commentary vein, point out that saying that his father was Gilead could have two meanings. Either it's an actual man named Gilead, or what we're hearing here is that he is the son of Gilead. Gilead is a geographical marker for this whole area, meaning he might be the son of any one of the men living in Gilead. He is a son of Gilead in some amorphous general sense because his father is a prostitute, so nobody knows who the father is. The next verse, as you will see, seems to imply that it's an actual man who fathered him, but we can still carry this interpretation forward. Let's look at it. But Gilead also had sons by his wife, and when the wife's sons grew up, they drove Iftach out. They said to him, "You shall have no share in our father's property, for you are the son of an outsider." When we read this verse, if we want to hold on to that more general reading that Gilead means the whole region, we need to stretch the meaning a little bit and treat it metaphorically, that it's not one wife of one man, but rather the legitimate sons of this region, all the people who grew up in normative, legitimate, sanctioned families, looked at the son of a prostitute and said, wait a minute, why should you be one amongst us? Why should you have land? Why should you have a stake in our community? And drove him out. And then when they say our father's property, they speak generally, not, it's really, they should say our father's, like in plural, properties. But the truth is that it doesn't matter how we take it. We can accept the more amorphous geographical marker type of interpretation, or say, no, it's the son of an actual man named Gilad. The truth is that one way or another, this little story is an indictment against the whole community. Even if it's the sons of one man named Gilad and not a general indicator for the whole town, the fact of the matter is that here we see a town where a family kicks out one of their own, and the community is fine with it. Nobody steps up. Nobody says, wait a minute, this is your brother we're talking about. It's not as horrific as Abimelech killing 70 of his brothers, or 69, but it is very cold. It's very harsh. And the next verse implies that it is backed with a threat. This banishment is backed with a threat of violence, because what we hear in verse 3 is, so Yiftach fled from his brothers and settled in the Tob country. Men of low character gathered around about Yiftach and went out raiding with him. In Hebrew, it says, Anashim Reikim, empty people, people who have no values, no character filling them. These are dangerous people who gather around Yiftach and fight with him, raid with him, go out to battle with him. In other words, become some combination of mercenaries and pirates, or bandits or highwaymen, however you call landlocked pirates. One way or another, as Eliezer Chayun points out again in the book about kingship, when someone flees, it's not because they're exiled or told to leave. If someone flees, it means that they're afraid of what will happen to them if they don't leave in haste. So when we see these brothers kicking out their father's illegitimate son, the implication is that the best he can hope for is to get away. And Eliezer Chayun treats that as another indication of a survival-centric or survival-obsessed society. In a survival-obsessed society, people don't feel outrage or don't act on their righteous indignation that somebody else is not carrying out their duty to their family members, and how dare they? No. Every family focuses on its own interest. Every person focuses on their own interest. The legitimate sons focus on their inheritance. The other townspeople focus on their business and not interfering with the immoral behavior of their neighbors. And this is the basis of the social contract. The basis of the social contract of a society in this kind of time, when survival is difficult and haphazard and not to be taken for granted, is every man for himself. If you can grasp something, you grasp it. If you can't, you run to fight another day. This is the best you can hope for. But much as we will see happens in God's case, when we go back to the previous chapter, the war, the same war that God allowed to come upon the people because they abandoned him and their duty towards him, doesn't only push the people to ask God for help. It pushes the people to ask Yiftach for help as well. And interestingly, Yiftach and God respond in very, very similar terms, at least at first. Let us go back to first see how God responds. I am back to box one in verse 10, after we hear about the distress that the Israelites are suffering from the Ammonites. Then the Israelites cried out to the Lord, "We stand guilty before you, for we have forsaken our God and serve the Baalim. But the Lord said to the Israelites, I have rescued you from the Egyptians, from the Amorites, from the Ammonites, and from the Philistines. The Sidonians, Amalek, and Maon also oppressed you. And when you cried out to me, I saved you from them. Yet you have forsaken me and have served other gods. No, I will not deliver you again. Go cry to the gods you have chosen. Let them deliver you in your time of distress. In other words, what kind of chutzpah is that? You who have worshipped every possible god and every possible pantheon except me, now turn to me for succor? Now that you want me to be saved, suddenly I'm good enough for you? And this sense of indignation of how dare you ask me for help after everything you did to me is exactly how Iftach will respond to a similar overture. Let's see that. I'm moving forward. I'm again in box 2, this time verse 4. Sometime later, the Ammonites went to war against Israel. And when the Ammonites attacked Israel, the elders of Gilead went to bring Iftach back from Tov country. They said to Iftach, come be our chief so that we can fight the Ammonites. Iftach replied to the elders of Gilead, you are the very people who rejected me and drove me out of my father's house. How can you come to me now when you are in trouble? Now, as we will see in one second, both Iftach and God do relent and actually help the people. Otherwise, the story would end here and would not be a story, in fact. But I think it's worth pausing for a second and asking ourselves, what does it teach us? What is the text achieving by making this very closely drawn parallel between God's experience with the people and Iftach's experience with the people? And at this stage in our conversation, I want to draw three conclusions. The first is that what we see by seeing that the same attitude is extended towards Iftach and towards God is that this is a society without a moral heart, or I should say perhaps a moral compass. Thank you. I could tell something was not quite right there. Thank you. Without a moral compass. They, not in unique circumstances, but regularly, don't recognize what the duty they owe is, what is the right thing to do, and instead are motivated by what they can grasp, what they can use for their survival, for their personal benefit at this moment. So this is one thing that we see, a certain, I would say, systematic failure of conscience. The other thing I want to point out is that Iftach's trouble, in a sense, stem from a disease or a flaw that lies in the relationship between brothers. And this, as we saw already several times in our course, is a disease or ill that haunts the Israelite story from the very beginning of Shoftim. The very beginning of Shoftim starts when the people ask, who shall ya'ale b'tchila, who shall go up first for us? And God says Yehuda. And instead of understanding it as Yehuda will lead all of the people together, Yehuda goes and fights their own little war along with Shimon that they make a special deal with, and leave all the other tribes to fight their own wars, which inevitably they fail to do because they don't have the united might of all the tribes together. And then we see it over and over again, this inability to come together and work together at moments of crisis, all together in enough numbers and with enough impact. So when we see Iftach being chased from his home by his own brothers, and when we see that Iftach is in some way a parallel of God, if I dare say that myself, or a stand-in for some of our saga with God, in a sense, it's almost as if the text is telling us to sit up and pay attention, because what will happen to Iftach is what we can expect to happen to the entire people, since he is shaped by the same sin or the same malaise that has started shaping the people from the first verses of Shoftim, the malaise of lack of brother. And third, the other great sin also comes front and center here. The sin of abandoning God, of idolatry, of betraying the covenant that ties us to God. The covenant that is often likened to the marriage bond. Also, marriage is called brit, right? The same word. And Iftach is technically chaste by his brothers, not by his father. But the root of his problem is his illegitimacy. The root of his problem is the fact that something about the relationship between his parents wasn't covenanted properly. It wasn't a properly covenanted marriage. And once again, it's almost as if the text is telling us, when there's a problem in the covenant, either the individual one between people or the national one between people and God, trouble will follow. And this one man, this one, I feel bad for him, you know, this one pitiful man, Iftach, with such a difficult and harsh beginning to his life, will become almost a representation or a demonstration for us of where the people can expect to be going next, where these sins of the era can be expected to lead them, so to speak. And the answer to the question where it expected to lead them is starting to become clear when we finally hit a divergence between God's response and Iftach's response. So far, we saw them only in parallel. Both are betrayed, both are approached when the people need them, both respond to the same people. Yes, the people of Gilad will approach both God and Iftach with righteous indignation. How dare you approach me now after the way you abandoned me and betrayed me? But then when they relent, the reason they relent and help the people is utterly different. And this perhaps is where we start seeing the fruits of Iftach's harsh and cruel upbringing in his own demeanor and treatment of his people, which is equally harsh and self-serving. Let us see the difference right here. This time I'm going to start with Iftach and then go to God. After Iftach tells the elders of Gilad in verse 7, why did you come to me when you were the ones who abandoned me? They answer like this in verse 8. The elders of Gilad said to Iftach, honestly, we have now turned back to you. If you come with us and fight the Ammonites, you shall be our commander over all the inhabitants of Gilad. In other words, first they're trying to say something more emotional, like here we are, we can be a community again. But they don't waste time on sentimentality. They know what motivates people in their society. As much as until now they were the ones in power and Iftach was the one on the outs of society, on the margins of society, they all operate under the same principles. They understand what they need to dangle in front of him to get him to do what they want. They don't tell him it's the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do. No, that's not the kind of society they are. They say it's in your self-interest. You, who are the banished one, will now be the commander over all of us. But Iftach is not so quick to accept. Instead, in verse 9, he says the following, just a second. Iftach said to the elders of Gilad, very well, if you bring me back to fight the Ammonites and the Lord delivers unto me, I am to be your commander. Now, the translation here is a little bit more smooth than the actual text in Hebrew, because what he actually says is, Anochi ehyeh lachem lerosh. No, sorry, I'll explain. He says, if you bring me back to fight and I win, I will be your head. And commentators, especially Mitsudat David here, explains what he says to them is, duh, obviously if I win, I'm going to become your head. This is not a good enough offer. In other words, you're asking me to fight, and the thing you're dangling to me is that if I win, I will be your head. It's not enough, good enough. Obviously, I'll be your head if I win. And they understand what he's implying, and they understand that he wants to be made their head before even fighting the war. And we can see that this is what I understand, because this is what they actually do. Instead of their original offer of making him head after the war, they do the following. And the elders of Gilad answered Iftach, "The Lord himself should be witness between us. We will do just as you have said." Iftach went with the elders of Gilad, and the people made him their commander and chief. And Iftach repeated all these terms before the Lord at Mitzpah. Now, it's hard to blame Iftach for not just jumping at the opportunity to help the people who betrayed and banished him, or at least watched as his family betrayed and banished him. But it is, regardless of our sympathies or lack of sympathy with him, it is worth noting that the terms of his relationship with the people now are founded upon power, control, and self-interest. The kind of contract he is creating or building, in a sense, is a contract that reflects his ability to take from them something that he wants. Until now, he didn't have that ability. All he could do was run for his life. Now he has the ability to grasp power over them, and he does, and he guarantees it. He bargains for it so that no matter what happens in the actual war, he will retain it. In other words, when your society is not motivated by morals or ideals, but rather by self-interest and survival and everybody grasping what they can, the best you can hope for is more of the same. Iftach doesn't represent the ability to open a new type of future. He is of the same kind of calculation, of the same kind of spiritual makeup as the people around him. And he is, in a sense, the hero they deserve, regardless of what they want. He is very much the hero they deserve. He is not coming from a place of compassion. And in that, he suddenly steps off or goes astray from the parallel we saw so far between him and God. Because when God faces the same reality of the people suffering, God's response is motivated by different things. I'm going back to box one. After God's scathing response of go ask the other gods that you worship to help you, in verse 15 it says, "But the Israelites implored the Lord, 'We stand guilty. Do to us as you see fit, only save us this day.' They removed the alien's God from among them and served the Lord, and he could not bear the miseries of Israel." This is all it tells us, that God could not bear it. In Hebrew, it says more. It says, "Vatikzar nafsho." His breath, his own soul becomes short. He can't take it anymore. God's relationship with the people, even though they abandoned the covenant, is founded upon a very different foundation than the relationship that Iftach builds with the people when he agrees to fight for them in return of having power over them. As we will see, it's not only that the people get the hero they deserved. In other words, the hero that matches their moral shortcomings or reflects the basis upon which they built their own society. But also Iftach himself, who might think at this moment that he's at the top of the world and finally achieved what recognition and power he dreamed of and finally can lord it over the people who turned him out earlier, he too will discover in the course of the story that when you build the foundation, when your relationship with people rests on a foundation of power play and self-interest, even achievements are short-lived and come to bite you in the end. And he finds that out in a horrific way in two, once again, parallel lines in his own life as a private man and in his experience as a leader of a people. Because on both of those planes, in both of those paths, so to speak, the victory which he does achieve in the war leads to destruction of a home. In one case, the private home, and in the other case, the national home. Let us see it together in the text. And I just want to be fair and say that the victory itself is quite glorious. Yes, it's not I'm kind of glossing over it because it's not the central point I'm trying to make here, and we only have an hour together, but it is a glorious victory and could rightly be placed in the list of victories that the book of Judges has. But the interestingest thing is where the victory leads. So let us follow that. We're starting right before the battle in box 3. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Iftach. He marched through Gilad and Menasheh, passing Mitzpeh of Gilad, and from Mitzpeh of Gilad he crossed over to the Ammonites. And Iftach made the following vow to the Lord. If you deliver the Ammonites into my hands, then whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me on my safe return from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's and shall be offered by me as a burnt offering. The Midrash immediately jumps on this neder, on this vow that he makes, and points out that this is a very problematic vow to make, regardless of how it played out, even if it would have played out perfectly, if a beautiful little cow would have come out of his house and would have been the most appropriate offering and everything would have been fine. The vow itself is problematic because it is not, it's not in his hands. Part of the idea of sacrifice is that you choose the best. And you give it to God. You offer to God the best you have. So much of the laws of sacrifice in Vayikra is about how to properly choose the right offering. I'm teaching now Vayikra in a different course. I've been reading over an awful lot of lists of how to bring the right kind of animal and what animal is right for your bracket of income and what are signs that this animal is no longer the best and should not be given. And in the Gemara, it goes even farther than that. And if in the case when you do to exchange the animal you set aside for offering, how to make sure that the other animal you bring is the same level of quality, I guess. I'm not even sure how the terms are when it comes to animals in English. But Iftach is not doing that. He is not saying, I will choose the best I have to give and gift it. He is saying, whatever comes. He is taking it out of his hands while offering is something that you take with your hands and bring to God. And in doing that, he opens himself to disaster. And the disaster does strike. I'm going to skip a little bit ahead to the next source. When Iftach arrived at his home in Mitzpah, there was his daughter after the victory, coming out to meet him with timbrel and dance. She was an only child. He had no other son or daughter. I want to pause here for a minute and note something about the storytelling that happens here. Because the storytelling here is extremely impactful. We're not even hearing any insertion, editorial insertion that tells us there was his daughter coming out to meet him first. Like in the vow he made, because it doesn't need to. We already remember it. We already feel the dread because we understand what's going on because we just saw this vow and here we see his daughter come out. And then it adds the detail that she's coming out with timbrel and dance, which just twists the knife a little bit in our emotions, right? Here she is coming out, dooming herself to be sacrificed by coming out. But what is she doing? She's dancing to celebrate his victory. So he's standing there being celebrated in the very moment that the victory turns to ashes in his mouth. And then just to twist it a little bit more, he tells us she was an only child. He had no other son or daughter. And here it's really worthy. It's worth stopping for a moment and really noting what this means. It means that what's about to happen with her is not just a tragedy on the personal level of one person being sacrificed, which is unimaginable, and I'm not trying to belittle it, chas v'chalila. But what we're seeing here also has impact beyond her own loss on Yiftach, because what it means is that he will have no living legacy after him. This man who started his life being kicked out of the home of his childhood is going to remain without a home in the sense of legacy of children to raise and pass his own wealth, position, knowledge, life experience to. He is the man who didn't receive anything from his antecedents, and now he's not going to have any descendants to give anything to. And at this point, we still might hope that he will find a way out, that he will find a way to change reality. Instead, Yiftach, the man who wasn't afraid of battle, who wasn't afraid of negotiating with the elders, treats this with complete defeatism. Because instead of railing against it and finding a way out, he accepts that this is what has to happen. In verse 35, on seeing her, he rent his clothes and said, "Alas, daughter, you have brought me low. You have become my troubler. For I have uttered a vow to the Lord, and I cannot retract." In Hebrew, "velo uchal lashuv," which means to return and has all the connotations of tshuva. And we all know that tshuva is a central pillar of Jewish experience and Jewish life. And there are very few things you can't do tshuva, return, for. And Chazal even say that tshuva kadma olam, the tshuva, the possibility to atone had to exist before the world, because otherwise the world would be a place of judgment, of justice without mercy, and a place of justice without mercy cannot stand. And yet Yiftach, trapped by his own speech, by his own careless vow, feels that these words that he uttered are unbreakable, are something that he cannot shake, that he cannot return from. And his daughter accepts it. "Father," she said, "you have uttered a vow to the Lord. Do to me as you have vowed, seeing that the Lord has vindicated you against your enemies, the Ammonites." She further said to her father, "Let this be done for me. Let me be for 2 months, and I will go with my companions and lament upon the hills, and there bewail my maidenhood." "Go," he replied. He let her go for 2 months, and she and her companions went and bewailed her maidenhood upon the hills. After 2 months' time, she returned to her father, and he did to her as he vowed. Now, I want to pause here for a second. Simply speaking, "he did to her as he vowed" sounds as if he sacrificed, human sacrifice. And that remains the pshat explanation. Some rabbis and commentators said, no, he didn't kill her. He locked her away for life so she couldn't have children, she couldn't live a life, and that counts as sacrifice. And they derive it from the following words: "She had never known a man." They say, why put the emphasis on this? Why lay the emphasis on the fact that she didn't have children or didn't have any marital relations? Because this is what he actually did to her. He stopped her from having children, from having a life beyond her. this interpretation certainly has a long tradition to stand behind it and has what to rely on in the text. The truth is, for our purposes here, the end result is not the same, but it's similarly tragic, because whether or not she died quickly right now or was locked away somewhere to languish alone for the rest of her days, Iftach's line is closed. Iftach, the man who, as we said already, didn't get anything from his parents and his brothers, didn't have a family to come from and accept things from, doesn't have any family to follow after him. The home he tried to build for himself has collapsed because the foundation of this home was rotten, was wrong. It was a foundation of self-interest, and as we see here, also of an odd carelessness in vows and defeatism in the face of their coming in to be, or of their results. We do need to take a step back, though, just a second. We can't really gloss over the fact, and here I will take a little bit of a step out of the pshat and into the drash and the historical context. It's hard to ignore the fact that right here we see a very clear violation of Torah. The Torah, the books of Moses, are very clear on not sacrificing children. We have a clear instruction not to kill people. We have a clear instruction not to bring our children to the Molech, which was human sacrifice practice, that child sacrifice practiced in Moab, a little to the south of Ammon and Gilad. And the question rises quite obviously, what on earth was Iftach thinking? How can you bring to God a sacrifice that goes against the grain, that goes against everything God stands for and asks of us, which is to respect human life and that a person should carry responsibility for their own sins or their own actions, not make somebody else pay for it with their lives? Chazal also felt that this was distressing and disturbing and somehow doesn't add up. And they offered several, I wouldn't say answers, but contexts to understand it in. One such context, or perhaps obvious interpretation, is that Iftach was an ignoramus. It really was not a legitimate thing, and the vow was not binding. The vow was not worth the air used to draw it, because you can't make a vow that goes against God's will. It's like, if I make a vow, and I'm not going to use the words, of course, that I'll never keep Shabbat again, this is not a legitimate vow. It's just invalid. If you make a vow to kill whoever comes out of your door again, when it can be a person or a pig, for that matter, the vow is invalid. As I already stated before, it goes against the spirit of sacrifice bringing, where we're supposed to choose our best and give it to God. This is not what this is about, even without the further horrific complication of human sacrifice. But then, of course, the obvious question rises, why didn't he know that? And here we have to take a little bit of a broader look, because we could argue that Iftach, the man who was kicked out of his home as a child and grew up surrounded by other bandits, there's good reason to assume that he never had an opportunity to learn the law properly. But he was not alone. At this point, he is the leader of Gilad. What, nobody in Gilad knew the law better? Nobody could say, wait a minute, this is not a legitimate thing? In a sense, the detail here that he sent her for 2 months out to the hills with her friends makes the incredulity that we should feel at this point even greater. Because it's not like he did it right away in his backyard before anybody could intervene. Enough people knew for 2 months what's about to happen. At least the fathers of our friends should have known. Presumably, the commander of the war doesn't come home on his own. Presumably, there are other people around him. Where were they? Once again, just as when we watched Iftach being banished from his house, we are led to ask ourselves, what kind of society is this? What kind of people are these surrounding him? Yiftach is unusual in his life story, in his tragedy, in his mission, even in his chosenness. But he is not unusual in his understanding of morality, his understanding how to handle reality. Chazal go a step further. Chazal say that when Yiftach lived, Pinchas, grandson of Aharon, lived also and was the great Kohen, the high priest. And they say Pinchas was a very knowledgeable man. We see him doing a lot of great things in other places. Why didn't he lehatir et haneder? Why didn't he break the vow? And they describe this ridiculous reality where Pinchas says, well, if he wants me to break the vow for him, he should come to me. Who is he anyway? He's this bastard son who just got some glory by fighting a war. He should come to me and ask, and I'll break the vow. And at the same time, Yiftach sits in his house in Gilad and says, who is he that I should go to him? He is just a priest. He doesn't know anything about life. I just won a glorious war under God's blessing. He should come to me. And the Midrash says in very harsh words that, well, this one was proud and this one was proud. Aluvazo, this poor girl, lost her life. In other words, the Midrash goes into the cracks in the story, into the incredulity that we must feel at the fact that nobody intervenes to stop, to remind us that Yiftach's problems are not just his own. The problems of Yiftach represent a crisis of leadership that pervades the whole society. Just as we said before that his fate, his childhood, in a sense, encapsulates the sin of the collapse of brotherhood and the sin of the broken covenant that haunt the whole book. What happens with his vow, what happens to the next generation of Yiftach's family, represents the collapse of leadership that's endemic for this whole era and leads to his home's collapse. And in case we didn't get it, in case we still think that the tragedy is only, and again, I don't want to belittle it, it's a horrible tragedy, but in case we still think that the main tragedy here is just the loss of his daughter, his life then continues and ends in a way that emphasizes the fact that the tragedy also has to do with a family line and its utter collapse. What we hear about Yiftach following this is Yiftach led Israel 6 years. Then Yiftach the Giladite died and he was buried. And now it's a little bit mistaken. The translation here says in one of the towns of Gilad. But what the Pasuk actually says is Be'arei Gilad, and in the towns of Gilad. And the Midrash says he died in this horrific disease that every time a different part of his body fell off and was buried somewhere else. He didn't die in a nice death. He didn't even live that long. He lived for 6 years after his victory, and that's it. His life was brutal and short. And to emphasize that, to emphasize just how miserly his portion of life and success was, the next judge that we know very little about is all about longevity and having many living children and a legacy. After him, Ibtsan of Bethlehem led Israel. He had 30 sons and he married off 30 daughters outside the clan and brought in 30 girls from outside the clan for his sons. He led Israel 7 years. Then Ibtsan died and was buried in Bethlehem. The man who was betrayed by those who came before him ends up betraying and abandoning she who comes after him and leaving nothing. And in case we are mistakenly led to think that this is a private tragedy of one man, the same scenario plays out on the national level. Because in between the sacrifice of his daughter his death, another episode takes place where suddenly the Ephraim, the Shevet Ephraim, the tribe of Ephraim, comes to Yiftach and says, why didn't you ask us to fight with you? Now, we already saw this happen once, if you remember, with Gideon's war, when the Ephraim also took exception. Sorry, I don't, just a second. Ephraim also took exception to not being invited to a war, probably telling us that they saw themselves as somewhat of a leading first among equals of the tribes and thought that other tribes shouldn't engage in geopolitical upheavals without their approval. But while Gideon diffused the situation by treating the Ephraim people with deference, Iftach immediately escalates it to bloodshed. The men of Ephraim mustered and crossed the Jordan to Tzafon. They said to Iftach, "Why did you march to fight the Ammonites without calling us to go with you? We'll burn your house down over you." Iftach answered them, "I and my people were in a bitter conflict with the Ammonites, and I summoned you, but you did not save me from them. When I saw that you were no saviors, I risked my life and advanced against the Ammonites, and the Lord delivered them into my hands. Why have you come here now to fight against me?" He doesn't wait for an answer. Instead, "And Iftach gathered all the men of Gilad and fought the Ephraimites. The men of Gilad defeated the Ephraimites." I'm skipping a little bit ahead. "The fords of the Jordan against the Ephraimites. And when any fugitive from Ephraim said, 'Let me cross,' the men of Gilad would ask him, 'Are you an Ephraimite?' If he said no, they would say to him, 'Then say Shibolet.' But he would say Sibolet, not being able to pronounce it correctly. Thereupon they would seize him and slay him by the fords of the Jordan. 42,000 Ephraimites fell at that time." Just as the private home collapses, so does the national home collapses. Just as the private family starts with violence and ends in bloodshed, so on the national level, the society that is moved by self-interest and survival, the best it can aspire for is a military victory and a brief sense of glory under a brutal man. That's the best they can aspire to. In other words, when the social contract is based on power and self-interest, Iftach is the best they can aspire to. He's a representation in a sense of what Hobbes talked about when he talked about the state of nature without a powerful state where people fight against each other all the time. And he said that it is brutal, mean, and short, that human life is brutal, mean, and short. Iftach, in a sense, could have that as a title over his short time in the limelight. Brutal, mean, and short. He is all they can aspire for. He is the brutal, mean, and short they can reach. Which leads me and you and us together to a bigger meta question about the book. Because if the thrust of this story is that military victory and a military leader who unites a group of people to fight a war against an enemy is not enough to break the patterns of society and make it a better place, heal the ills that plague it. If even someone like Iftach, who successfully leads the people to war, can't change the game, can't change the tune, can't change the texture of reality, why does the book in later chapters, which we will reach in 2 weeks, push us to kingship as a solution? Later in the book, we're going to see all these horrific situations, and all of them will be preceded or sealed or finished with a statement: in those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was straight in their own eyes. And it's fairly clear. This is even the final words of the book. So it's pretty clear that the book is pushing us to understand towards its end. We didn't reach it yet. We will soon. To understand that kingship will be the solution. Kingship is what will get people out of the horrific cycle and ills and sins of the era. But a king is a military leader who leads people in war and protects them from enemies. And as we see in Iftach's case, that is simply not enough. It's just not enough. It just doesn't help. Perhaps to answer this question, we need to shift our perspective a little bit and say that the book tells us, yes, we will need a leader, a king, to get us out of this mess, to break the pattern. But any king won't do it. It's not any king. It's not a king. We need a king who is the antithesis of Iftach's brand of leadership. We need a king who will help the people out of compassion and not in pursuit of self-interest. We need a king who, when he makes a vow or when he sets himself on a certain path, can return from the brink of disaster that he himself created and change course. We need a king who, when he looks at the people around him, doesn't see a resource to exploit, but his partners in a covenant with God. It'll take us quite a while. We will have to finish the book of Shoftim and read through a lot of Shmuel Aleph and watch the rise and fall in Shaul until we meet King David, who will be able to be those things, to help the people out of compassion, and when he makes mistakes, to recalibrate his course. But already here in this horrific tragedy of the Shofet named Iftach, we see a hint as to what we should be looking for, what we should be keeping our eyes open for, and therefore perhaps a slightly more optimistic end to what is otherwise a very difficult, emotionally wrenching narrative. Thank you, everybody. I don't have time to answer all the questions or comments in the chat. For those of you who can stay for a few more minutes, I will try and address some of them. But Rabbi Kelman, do you need to say something now? Or?
No. You addressed the question just at 1:15. Shuli will be starting. So as long as we finish by 1:11.
Yeah. I have
which
even less.
Will.
I have children.
Yeah, yeah,
I have
yeah.
hungry
Thank
children
you.
Waiting
Thank
for me.
No
in the next
problem.
Room.
I'll be quiet.
No problem. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Debbie Sondheim, are you here?
Yes, I am.
So Debbie wrote, it seems like an echo of David's origin story. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Just that he was also distanced by his brothers. He was not accepted. And then, when Shmuel comes to anoint, and Yishai brings out everybody, and then Yishai says, Shmuel says, is there anybody else? And then Yishai says, well, actually, there is, as if mm-hmm. he's the runt of the litter. And that is the one, Hashem Yireh Lalevav, Adam, sees the outside. And it just struck me as here, Yiftach too was excluded. And then he became the top. But
let's add to that. He's also a gangster hanging out with Anashim Reikim. In other words, when he's on the run, he hangs out not with respectable people, but
right.
people who are quite unrespectable, exactly the same type of people Yiftach was hanging out with.
Excellent point, both of you. Thank you, Debbie, and thank you, Yehudi.
Right, you got it right.
And I think it's very interesting, especially since, as I tried to show, I think the end of the story, in a sense, explicates to us what we need from a king, and then David comes and delivers on those needs another book down the line. So the parallels between Iftach and David, I think, are very deliberate. David is fashioned after Iftach, or Iftach after David is less important. But the parallel and then the break of the parallel, in what ways are they living the same life story or a similar life story, but not responding to it in the same way? That's where the story becomes really fascinating. So thank you for sharing this.
And where do they divert?
Was attached to God.
What?
David is attached to God. When we first hear David speak, the time of, with Goliath, he said, I was able to protect my my flock and kill the lion, and God helped me, and God will help me again. So I don't see that. That was the thing that with Yiftach, he didn't seem to have the connection with God.
Yes, he does. In his speech to B'nai Ammon, it's clear that he considers himself as representing God. That's the longest diplomatic
speech. He said, God is with him, and God is the power.
I think you're both right, but you're placing the emphasis differently. He mentions God a fair amount in his speech to B'nai Ammon, which we didn't talk about at all. And even in his vow, right? The vow shows that he does feel that as careless and doomed as this vow is, it shows that he cares about God and feels that God is the one who should grant him victory. He's not making a vow to all the gods that the people worshiped before, right? We had that long, long list, the whole verse of a whole pantheon of gods to worship. No, he makes a vow to God. But I would argue, and here I agree, with Batya, that the way he talks about God is very telling, because it's kind of a quid pro quo sort of conversation. It's like, you do for me, I do for you. This is not the way David talks about God. David talks about God as, if God wills that he will empower me to do something good for other people.
Not with Naval, he doesn't say that.
I'm sorry?
He's acting like a real gangster, coming up and asking for protection money. And then
he has to kill
everybody there if the protection money isn't delivered. That sure sounds like gangster operation to me.
David is the most complicated.
Come out of it, but that's what he intended to do. And I don't see him talking about God there either. Except at one point when he says, "Kol Yasel him we below Kol Yosef, if I don't kill everybody in that household before dawn." That doesn't sound to me like a person who has got God on his mind, you know?
I'll put it differently, Yudi. I'll put it differently. I'm not saying in every instance of his life David spoke like that. I mean in the David and Goliath example, which Batya brought up. And I think there's plenty of other examples. David is probably the most complex and ambiguous character in Tanakh, in my opinion, personally. So as we read him, we discover many, many faces. And part of the difficulty is that we don't know which faces he feels earnestly and which faces he wears for public presentation. And I don't know if you're familiar with Rabbi Wolpe's book about David, the Divided Heart.
Yeah.
So it's an excellent analysis of this duality or complexity. And since this is a book about Shoftim, and we're just referencing David a little bit as something that's foreshadowed or made deeper with a comparison to Yiftach, I can't really get into a longer conversation, even though I wish I could. It's one of my favorite problems to delve into, maybe in a different course. For now, I will just say that in those places when David does talk about God, there is a certain emotional resonance. Not every time. Sometimes he vows in the name of God. I don't mean that. There's a certain sense of partnership, of empathic connection. Definitely David of the Psalms is like that. But even in Shmuel, we see glimpses of that. I don't see that in Yiftach. That is what I meant to say. That in Yiftach, it's a much more contractual than covenantal relationship.
But that's the young Jacob. If God does this on his journey to his father's home, his grandfather's homeland, which he does change, but that contractual thing is the young Jacob.
Correct. And Chana makes a similar contract. Chana, one of my favorite characters, makes a similar contract with God when she, in the very beginning of Shmuel, asks for a son, demands a son. She makes a deal. She says, "If you give me a son, he will be yours. I will give him back to you." Again, the question is not, I'm sorry?
All vows are deals.
Exactly. But the point is not that it's not okay to make a contract with God. The point is that in Yaakov, as in David, as in Hana, we see a much broader array of ways to relate to God that show a deeper connection in Hana's words of thanks to God, in David's conversations with God or about God, in Yaakov's long life of living under God's guidance. There's a lot more. Iftach, perhaps because we only see a glimpse. I'm not trying to make a judgment about his life. I'm talking about Iftach as he is presented to us by the text. The first thing that motivates him is his self-interest. If he can make the deal with God to help his self-interest, he does. And the spirit of God does come upon him when he fights the war. He is a shofet. He fights for the people. But perhaps this lends a bit more depth to why he doesn't cancel his vow, in a sense, to why he doesn't break apart his vow. Because
why
if
do the people step up like they did for Yehonatan?
Just a minute. If all you have with God is a contractual relationship, maybe it's harder for you to break the contract. Whereas if you have a richer, fuller relationship with God, then the contract you make is just a part of that, and you might be able to renegotiate it. You pointed out the I'm going to address one last thing, and then we have to wrap up. Yehuda, you pointed out the parallel to Yonatan, right?
Yeah, the people step up and they redeem him, even though he violated the communal oath. So why didn't they do that in Yiftach's time?
And, I mean, I can't answer for the people. Of course, I think if anything, I would rephrase the question. I would reframe what you're saying and put it this way. It is telling that the people don't step up. In Yonatan's case, they step up because they love Yonatan. Yonatan is their hero at this point. He led them to this enormous victory and is clearly very beloved by the people. And they step up for him. When Shaul doesn't have the, I don't know, guts to say, I'm abandoning my oath, the people give him the out to do it by stepping up. By the way, the fact that Shaul feels bound by the oath, in a sense, put him in Iftach's camp, and it has been remarked upon by Chazal that here Shaul proves that he is more of the judges era than the kingship era, that he is still making the same mistakes of feeling bound by an oath that is inappropriate, as we will see happens more than once in Shoftim. Here we're talking just about Iftach. We'll see that again in Pilegish Bogivai in a few weeks. But the fact that here, when Iftach is about to commit this horrific thing, the people don't stand up, tells us something about the society they live in. And it's wonderful to see that the society transforms and that the society becomes something more than it is by the time we reach the Book of Shmuel. And on that more optimistic note, I am going to wrap up and check on my children in the other room. Good night, everybody. Thank you. Good night, everybody. Thank you for contributing with your questions. I'm sorry if I didn't have time to address.
Amazing class. Amazing class.
Thank you. Wonderful to see all of you.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah.